Welcome to Friday. Welcome to the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us. And I'm joined, as are you, by the Stranger's culture critic, film editor, filmmaker, Charles Medetti. Welcome, Charles.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
From Q13 News, political reporter C.R. Douglas. Welcome back, C.R.
Hello, Bill.
Joni Balter, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. This is our Week in Review panel as we figure out what happened this week. And Seattle's Como TV anchor Molly Shen says, no, she was not forced to read the words written by her corporate boss, the Sinclair Broadcast Group. Shen joined other Sinclair anchors across the country in reading a promotional spot about the problem of fake news, and the website, Deadspin, produced a video mashup of dozens of those anchors reading the identical words.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and false news
has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these.
Well, this week, Como's Molly Shen wrote on Facebook, quote, I was not forced. I didn't do it to save my job or anyone else's. I did it because I do sincerely believe in what we do every day at Como as local journalists, and I do believe that fake news is a problem. Now, there's more to say about the obviously right-wing leaning Sinclair, but first, is anyone here upset with Sinclair or Como or Molly Shen?
I'll say that I'm upset with the whole thing. I think it's a PR disaster for Sinclair. You know, this comes at a time when they're trying to merge with Tribune, and It also comes at a time when you have the president of the United States at war with the First Amendment, at war with all these media companies. And, you know, this really is kind of dangerous. Media conglomeration is something that people just roll their eyes over. We used to write these editorials at the Seattle Times endlessly, and I got to give credit to Frank Blethyn, because the publisher of the paper, it was something that was long worried about. This is what it looks like. It doesn't look good. This is to have people all across the country stating the same script, they do look like hostages. That's what people have described them as. And to call everything, this term fake news, can we just like throw it out? It doesn't mean anything anymore. It just seems to mean news that you don't like. Okay?
Isn't any other reactions?
Well, let me give a disclaimer first, because my channel actually is owned by Tribune, and we are part of this drama, if you will.
So Sinclair would own Q13?
Well, actually, what's going to happen very likely is that in markets where they would own two stations, Sinclair already owns Como, the FCC rules doesn't allow you to own two stations. So as part of the merger condition, it looks like they're going to require that Sinclair not own these 10 stations, including ours, that are in these double markets. Yeah. So we are likely to be sold off and not be part of Sinclair. That's the better than likely chance, but who knows, that rule could change. I just throw that out there as
having disclaimed that.
Understand the context I'm coming from. I think Molly Shen is the exception. When you talk to and listen to all these anchors around the country, they have grumbled and certainly whispered that they've hated to do this. They didn't want to read a corporate script, especially one that brings up these buzzwords like fake news. I mean, this put many of them into a fight they don't want to be in, which is Donald Trump's, you know, war against the mainstream media, if you will. They don't want to be in that fight. They feel like this put them in that fight. And I think other than Molly Shen, most people feel like that's unfair.
Okay. So I hear both of you saying this looks bad in many ways. Charles, was there anything about the actual script that these anchors read that set you off? What was the problem, biggest problem?
I have to say, okay, I'm going to be a little critical in the sense that, okay, the anchor news, local news has really, for the most part, already been on the right of the political spectrum. I'm going to say that, right? It hasn't really done leftist work and that sort of thing, right? They sort of imagine that they're representing the middle, and they speak to an imagined middle and this sort of thing. And so to me, it's really fascinating to see them forced to read right-wing propaganda. It's like, you didn't really need to do that. So to me, the funny thing is, why did you make them do something that they could have done very easily and without the embarrassment? This is just my read on it. But it did damage their credibility. you know, which is neutrality. So, now, I mean, when you look at that video, it's haunting. You're like watching some kind of horror film from the 1980s, you know, or something of that kind. But that's my opinion.
Okay, so I've heard again that this announcement that all these anchors had to read violated their neutrality. But this is the script. We're concerned about the troubling trend of irresponsible, one-sided news stories plaguing our country. Tell me when I get to the controversial part. The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media.
Well, that's
anything
wrong.
Bad yet? What?
Yeah, that's nonsense.
Which part?
Actually, everything you've said so far.
Okay, tell me. Because this seemed pretty anodyne to me. I hear this all the time.
Well,
we say this at our pledge drives. We point
on.
Out that, you know what, there's a lot of unreliable stuff out there. And KOW, we purposely try to be better than that. So what's the difference?
Well, we know that we've been hearing from Donald Trump for the past, whole year, complaining that the media and the news is biased and calling news stations like the CNN and so forth and so on.
Exactly. He is specifically calling out the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN, labeling them fake news. This bland statement that Sinclair read doesn't say anything about left-wing media or liberal. In fact, it ends, which Deadspin left out, but it ends saying, we understand truth is neither politically left nor right. Now, you may think that they're full of it, but it wasn't. Where was the what was the inflammatory or the biased part of the statement? Besides that, they use the phrase fake news very differently from how Trump uses it.
I would say it's things you haven't read yet, which is just the next sentence,
okay.
Which is more alarming. Some media outlets publish these same fake stories. I think fake stories is a clear buzzword there.
But what are they implying when they say some media outlets publish these same fake stories?
What they're implying is that, you know, stories that they don't like are fake. And this is an attack on truth and the journalist's right to gather information. So,
but isn't that what journalists do, is distinguish between fake and not fake? And
yes, but to brand a group of newspapers or TV stations as fake because they report.
Which brand? Which group?
They just said, and then that's the next sentence that I have a problem with.
Okay.
Unfortunately, some members of the media use their platform to push their own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what people think. Now, that's a very loaded phrase right there. Who are these members of the media? Who's got the axe to grind? What biases are they pushing? There is some kernel to that, but when asked what they meant, give examples, they refuse to do so.
Well,
so
actually,
Sinclair does not say who these people are and what these organizations are.
I thought Sinclair says it produced the spots to express concern about the spread of such false media reports as the Pope endorses Trump fake news story and the Pizzagate conspiracy story that came out right before the presidential election.
That was all they said when asked to give examples. Not specific people who have axe to grind or institutions. They talked about two stories which started in conspiracy corners of the internet and percolated there. They were never picked up by national news outlets. They were never picked up by the mainstream media. So if Sinclair has a problem with all these people, why aren't they willing to say who they are? Because the problem is if you're not willing to...
So you want the anchors to call out specific news organizations.
Well, if you're not willing to say what the problem is, then why is Sinclair so sure they're the answer? Maybe Sinclair is part of the problem. Maybe Sinclair is the answer. Is your problem Hannity? Then there's one solution there. If your problem is Rachel Maddow, it's one solution there. If your problem is the network news anchors, there's a different solution. If your problem is the New York Times, why are they not willing to say what the problem is?
Well, Molly Shen called it a promotional spot. So you wanted this spot to be much more like a commentary that described news organizations and specific news stories, because she's saying it's like an image spot. It's a hello.
Here's the deal.
For tuning in. We're going to do our best to be fair and balanced.
Here's the deal: when you have every anchor that works for them having to repeat in this Orwellian fashion the same script, you have these sort of like robots who are now. These are people we turn to.
That was a brilliant mashup, just to show you the effect of all anchors around the country.
Oh, absolutely.
Great satire.
You've got to give it up for Deadspin for putting that together. You've got to give it up for Mary Nam for writing a different tweet that's saying this isn't funny and it really is dangerous when media companies all get together, buy each other up, and there's no diversity of opinion like that. The other thing that I think is missing from what we've been saying so far is the context. So what is Sinclair, what kind of commentary in addition to that does Sinclair put out?
That's fair.
So that is...
They're clearly a right-wing
Yeah, they're clearly right-wing, and they're saying other stuff that's not like this is fake news. And I think that's the danger, always attacking the truth. So there can be no truths? Is that the way we do this?
Yeah, it's been for about a while now, about since, what, about two or so years, there has been reports coming out of Como and so forth and so on about specific stories have to run, and they're usually left or right-leaning stories. So when they say this, it's not coming out of a vacuum, right? It's not coming out of nowhere. You know, it's definitely going to be associated with a kind of agenda that's already defined by their coverage. I mean, so I'm just going to say, I mean, it's just like, it's hard for me to believe that that is not innocent, and the wording is not innocent, and the moment is not innocent as well.
I'm just saying, then let's talk about what we're really talking about, which it sounds like Sinclair, they remind me of Fox News. We have Fox News, so what's the important difference?
Well, just a couple things on your earlier question, though. When you use buzzwords like fake news and in the context of what Sinclair is, I think it's pretty clear what this meant. And if they didn't intend it that way, at least that's how it's been taken, and they should have been aware of that. If you want to do a more anodyne version of this and say, hey, and we all kind of have done this. I mean, stations and news outlets have done these sort of promos. Hey, we're your trusted news source.
Right.
We're there to get the story. I think that's all fine. I don't think anyone objects to that. It's the language that was used here that gets them involved in this larger national fight.
Yeah.
And I think that was unfair to the journalists.
And we have more consolidation, and we have Sinclair wanting to own even more stations by buying up the Tribune. Okay, so related to that in the media world, any reaction to... So Donald Trump and Jeff Bezos, quote, inhabit very different worlds, said the Washington Post's publisher this week. Bezos owns the Post, and the Post often criticizes Trump. But the Post's chief executive and publisher, Frederick Ryan Jr., says Jeff has never proposed a story. Jeff has never intervened in a story. He's never critiqued a story. He's not directed or proposed editorials or endorsements. The decisions are made here. Trump accuses Amazon of evading taxes and wiping out small businesses and taking advantage of cheap delivery by the Postal Service, and he calls the Washington Post fake news. But this week, the Post senior editor said Trump's complaints highlight a severe fracture in American society. Quote, the president is a staunch bricks and mortar man who made his fortune building towers and dealing with blue-collar workers. The founder of the world's largest store is a space enthusiast who experiments with robots and operates much of the cloud where the new economy's data lives. The president has never been known to shop online and does not use a computer. This split is as much philosophical as it is economic, as much about the fraying of communities as it is about the shape of commerce.
Seems to me it's also about ego. I think that Jeff Bezos is somebody that Donald Trump would naturally be envious of. He's younger. He's never gone bankrupt as a businessman. You know, he actually, and you can argue about the whole antitrust thing that seems to be looming throughout this. I interviewed for a piece I did for Bloomberg View this week, this professor from Babson College. His name's Peter Cohen. And he was talking to if you want to get into the whole antitrust business, you know, actually, Amazon is not really a likely target for it because its business practices end up benefiting the consumer. Prices get lower, not higher. And so Donald Trump seems so envious of Jeff Bezos, and he's particularly just mad at his newspaper for the things they've found out about that go on behind the walls of the White House.
Yeah, it's hard for me to really accept that criticism from the Washington Post editor about these different kinds of conceptual business models or whatever concepts of business. I think that it's not that sophisticated.
You know, it's way lower.
Simpler. You shouldn't try to think too hard about this, right? I absolutely trying to say that Trump didn't shop online and therefore he's angry at Amazon is almost as funny as the stuff Trump says. I mean, it's just like, no. It's more like Trump gets you know, revealed a lot in the Washington Post, and the Washington Post reveals a lot of the stuff he does because readers, you know, are attracted to those stories. I mean, and so there's a conflict between, you know, a person who's trying to, you know, maintain his image as someone who's doing great for America and so forth and so on, against reports that he's, of course, making a mess of everything, and he's got a past that's kind of not so pretty and all this sort of thing. And you know, I mean, finally, I mean, the stuff about him worrying about taxes is laughable. I mean, I don't know why everybody's not laughing when he says they're not paying their taxes. I mean, at that point, you know, we should all just, like, you know, we should just be in tears, you know, just on the table. Like, who cares? I mean, we just had a huge tax cut, like, not too long ago. And, you know, and
we have no idea what taxes the president pays or has paid or will pay.
So the Washington Post, it sounds like, could really have gone a lot harder after Trump in that piece. Oh. Once again, Bezos carrying the water for Trump.
Yes, he is.
Typical.
Yeah.
The president has a history of kind of a loud bark and a soft bite, and my guess is that will be the same case here. I think he likes bringing this up. I think this feels fun for him, feels like you can have a lot of tweets about it, but I doubt that anything will come of it. I don't think they're going to break the company up. I don't think, especially with the kind of people he's putting into regulatory positions, that much will happen. This plays well for him. I mean, the fact is that Amazon is there's a frustration with Amazon on the left, as well as in other parts of kind of the ideology. I mean, Trump sometimes plays a Republican establishment figure, and he sometimes plays a populist. Mm-hmm. And the populist part of him is coming out in this. I mean, there's a whole bunch of folks, the Bernie Sanders left, that does not like Amazon, doesn't like what it's doing to kind of small town America, doesn't like what it's doing to society. So Trump effectively brought that coalition together in his campaign. And he's kind of working that again, it seems to me, to kind of, you know, split the Democratic coalition. You know, he was effectively able to kind of make Hillary Clinton the sort of, you know, Goldman Sachs candidate, and he was the populist, and this is part of that.
I think that's right. But in addition, we have to consider how weird it is for an American president to be railing, you know, many weeks against different individual businesses. It's pretty unusual. It's pretty hard for a Republican president to get on the wrong side of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which he managed to do with this. CNN Money ran a list of all the companies Trump, for the week of rage that he has from time to time, has been against. Remember when he was mad at Nordstrom for not carrying Ivanka's brand because it wasn't selling? Was the reason there. He's been mad at Verizon. He's been mad at AOL. He's mad at Coca-Cola, but he drinks it all day. I mean, it's just unusual. What if a Democratic president railed against a company prompting stock losses like this is going on? This is unusual, and it just speaks to that sort of everyday Trump is mad at something, somebody. And it just goes, it runs its cycle, whatever that is.
Meanwhile, it's hard to pin down Jeff Bezos politically. Bezos donated to the campaign to defeat a Washington state initiative to tax the rich. He and his wife made a $2.5 million gift to the Washington state drive to legalize same-sex marriage. Either way, King County records show him as an infrequent voter. He voted in 9 of the 38 elections held between 1996 and last year. You're listening to The Week in Review on KOW, and coming up, we're going to talk about some tough medicine in Seattle, possibly. They're studying the idea of a traffic decongestant, and the streetcar seems kind of plugged up, and parking is a little runny around here, too, so we'll get on into all that. Stay tuned. Week in Review today is C.R. Douglas and Joni Balter and Charles Mudede. And this week, Seattle's mayor, Jenny Durkin, said the city will study a new system of tolls on Seattle streets known as congestion pricing. Durkin said the tolls could, for example, rise at rush hour. We're already used to that.
Uber and Lyft, for example, they charge congestion pricing. They just call it surge pricing. So a city has to be at least that innovative to look at how do we make sure that we're maximizing the city core resources for the people that live and work here.
Durkin says the money raised would pay for more transit service and electric vehicle charging stations. Bad idea, says Yuri Crockett, who drives a pump truck for General Biodiesel in Seattle. He doesn't want to see a charge for driving downtown.
I think that's a ridiculous idea and just another opportunity for our elected government to tax the less fortunate in our communities. I don't understand how is that going to help traffic or what good it's going to do for us other than taking money from other hardworking people when they have to pay that fee.
London has congestion pricing. Stockholm, Milan, Singapore, New York keeps bringing it up and never doing it. Who thinks that this is actually going to happen in Seattle?
So I don't think it's going to happen in Seattle, but I think we have to be open-minded enough to experiment with it, to study it, to know more about it. Many American cities have been studying it. Seattle's looked at it before. I'm open to the experiment of it. I'm a little worried about the elitist nature of it. It ends up being that the rich folks have the easy access to Seattle landmarks and Seattle businesses. I was very impressed, I would say, by Seattle businesses, which didn't overreact to the idea of a study. They said, we need to know more. They were very cool about it. I can't imagine that they think this is going to help them when they have so many troubles with, basically our last topic, e-commerce. Trying to save their businesses and things like that. So I think there's a big argument and big discussion to have. I mean, imagine, and I'm thinking of the person who just spoke. So you drive into Seattle from Tenasket for your once a year Mariner game, and you get home and you get a little present in the mail that says, thanks for visiting. Actually, it just makes you matter at the big city, the expensive city for the elites.
I'm with you on that. I'm a little, how do you put it, on the fence about it. Well, first of all, it was sort of announced in the same week when she stopped the project on the streetcar. So I'm wondering if there's a connection between the two.
More about that in a moment.
Well, I just want to bring that up because, in a way, I don't think it's coincidental. I mean, with the streetcar, sort of the stop on the construction sort of was bad news because the people in the transportation community were upset about it, and it's been in a project for years and years. I don't want to get into it entirely. I know we're going to talk about that later. But then to suddenly come up and say congestion, which I'm sure it was probably on their minds and so on and so on, but the coincidence is, to me, the real problem. I mean, I don't know if pricing is going to happen. It's still something like a pie in the sky for me. To implement it, it's going to, be a real political difficulty, right? And some people say that if they do implement it, people will love it and so forth and so on. One person, I think, compared to it'll be like smoking the smoke ban, right? It'll be something like that. So people will suddenly say, oh, of course you do this. But, and apparently it works very well in Stockholm and all this sort of stuff. But there is this... I mean, it's hard to impose it so universally because we are already under such difficulties in terms of accommodating people who are poor or who are, mm-hmm. who are going through, who are already struggling with rent and so forth and so on. I mean, it seems really strange to propose this without specifics along those lines.
I think there's a better than even chance that this will happen. Not next year, not the following year, but in 4 or 5 years. And let's just be clear about what this is. This would draw a circle kind of around the downtown area. So a 3 or 4 mile circle and kind of getting in and out of downtown is where it would cost you. So it's not the whole city. It's just the center city. The problem with congestion downtown is that they're out of tools. I mean, they have tried everything to relieve it. They've added billions. I mean, it's the city and the region. If you count up light rail, more bus service, rapid ride bus service, metro van pools, carpool lots, free Orca cards, bike lanes, pedestrian routes. I mean, everything has been tried and the problem still gets worse. So there's really no more solutions other than big, grand, crazy things like this. I mean, if we keep putting more people and jobs and businesses and residential units downtown, it's only going to get worse. When you have a mayor sounding as sympathetic to the idea as Jenny Durkin just did in that piece, that suggests this has legs.
But it's complicated also by the fact that there's going to be tolling in the tunnel. So you can't toll everything. Pretty soon everybody's going to say, I don't want to go downtown. And we fought for many years to save downtown around here.
I would argue, actually, that is one of the drivers, because the state is going to toll that new SR-99 tunnel starting, you know, I think the first of next year. That tolls create the need for more tolls. If the 99 tunnel wasn't going to be tolled, I don't think this would have as much legs. The fact that that's going to be tolled means there's going to be diversion. There's going to be people avoiding that that go to I-5, that go to city streets. The toll on 99 creates a problem that argues for more tolls around the system, actually. Well, unfortunately.
Do you think that tolls also make us more used to tolls, so that if we already have, we have hot lanes, we have 520 and good to go and the waterfront tunnel coming, or do you think that in the near future the people of the Seattle area will just become more used to, and we're going to be possibly tracked so that we're paying our car taxes by the mile instead of by gas? Or do you think this will be less controversial over time or more?
You know, Seattle right now is, I don't think we've run out of options, out of like conventional options as well. I just want to say that. I think that we haven't pushed public transportation far enough. I can even say that New York City hasn't pushed public transportation far enough, and they're way ahead of us. Right. We haven't.
What else is there to be done? Public transportation. Buses.
More trains. Dedicated lanes for buses, and so forth and so on. And we need to do these things faster. The progress is too slow. And we need to be more decisive in these issues. I mean, right now, what you need is the kind of enthusiasm that brought up out of the dreams that brought I-5, you know, cutting across Seattle. That's the kind of will you need at this moment. We have not seen that kind of energy exerted towards public transportation yet in Seattle.
So you know what New York did do? So they considered all these different proposals, got very, very close to congestion pricing, and then didn't do that in the final budget. But they did add surcharges for Uber, Lyft, and Yellow Cab for each trip below 96th Street, I think, in Manhattan. And so they inched toward something like this. So I don't think we've also accounted for how much these Uber and Lyft and even Amazon deliveries may, in fact, increase our traffic. I don't think we've ever had that discussion.
With your question about tolls and whether we adapt to them, the answer is yes. I think the fact is, if you look around our region and around the country and the world, the human psyche is such that it reacts to tolls negatively at first, and then it ultimately adapts. I mean, there was a lot of outrage to when they put a toll on 520, and now people basically, you end up getting your good-to-go pass. My guess is that if they implement this, that there will be some pushback and ultimate acceptance. I mean, that's what happened in Stockholm. That's what happened in Milan. That's what happened in London. I mean, people sort of didn't like it, and then they lived with it.
Finally, here's one.
In fact, they won public votes
these. Tolls are great for crime films as well.
Tolls are great for crime films.
No, he's talking about the toll booth in
the toll booth
in The Godfather. That's what he's talking about. Okay.
Hey, here's one more idea from our transit consultant, Jarrett Walker. He says, you know, the problem is the name, congestion pricing. Nobody's going to rally behind something with the word congestion in it.
I've suggested the term decongestion pricing because that is what the price buys, less congested streets with more room for people of all modes to get through.
Decongestion pricing. Fresh air pricing. Yeah. It's like if you don't like the inheritance tax, you call it a death tax. It sounds grim.
I think that's a brilliant branding.
How about evacuation pricing?
Evacuation pricing. Who doesn't love the idea of evacuation?
Gentrification pricing.
Let's say just a little more about the streetcar that Charles mentioned. Seattle has these two disconnected streetcar lines, one from Pioneer Square to Capitol Hill, one from Westlake to South Lake Union, and the plan was to connect them with a streetcar down First Avenue downtown. Last month, the Seattle Times reported that the cost of operating the streetcar system could be 50% higher than what the city has said. So Mayor Durkan has reviewed the budget, found a big shortfall, and ordered a stop to the project. The city says that delay could last 6 months, which would increase the project's cost another $10 to $14 million. So does anyone think at this point that we're going to leave the two lines unconnected, or are we just going to pay more for the mismanagement?
I think the cost overrun was a fabulous excuse for the mayor to get out of this, something that takes up a ton of space, doesn't move a lot of people, and nobody seems to love anymore. I don't know where this thing came from. So I think that just the fact that the finances were so messed up was a perfect moment to pause, look at it, and say, this isn't the best use of our dollars. That seems to me what she's saying.
So you think they're going to stay disconnected? Or they're just going to get built eventually?
I don't think they're
going to
build the first. No, I think, I think she's on her way out from this thing, and I think it's a good thing.
I agree with you, and I'm sad that that's going to happen because we. I mean, first of all, as often pointed out, we don't really have anything else going for us for a while to deal with downtown traffic in terms of adding transportation possibilities. But one thing is for sure. Is that I always look for the origin of the sin. Right? Mm. Where did the sin come from? And it's because all this starts really with the fact that we didn't open a station on First Hill. The Link didn't open a station on First Hill. The money that was supposed to go into that station turned into the First Hill car streetcar. Mm-hmm. And so this has been like an extension of sadly, an idea I never really liked, and I would have preferred dedicated lanes for buses and so forth and so on down that corridor. I'm not really a big fan of the streetcar.
I predict that Durkin won't kill it, but that she'll get involved in the finances, figure out a way to scale those costs back, come out with a new proposal that's cheaper and looks like the fiscal hero in the process. That's just my suspicion.
Okay.
Killing it completely, actually, there are some drawbacks to killing it completely. What we have now is kind of the worst system you can have, which is two streetcar lines that don't meet up. Mm-hmm. So if you add the third missing link, if you will, so this connects the South Lake Union to the Pioneer Square lines, you then create a system that actually goes somewhere. It's not just a monorail to nowhere, each of these lines.
Slowly.
But the point is you'll get multiples of ridership. Now they've been too optimistic about the ridership so far, but there is an argument, there's about 6,000 riders a day on if you combine both the streetcars now, that will be 25,000 once you connect them. So there is a synergy you get if you put this link in, and I think that's going to still be very compelling to people like Jenny Durkin and city planners.
And if you put together original sin and synergy, you get original synergy. That could be the name of the streetcar line.
But I'm totally against it.
The other name wasn't so good either for South Lake Union,
yeah,
let's
be honest, though, overruns and trying to, you know, act like you're being responsible fiscally is a bunch of nonsense. I mean, let's be honest. Berth, you know, what is it? The tunnel had overruns. There are overruns with the new Magnolia Bridge. I mean, this happens all the time. And, you know, there's also complicated factors. Right now, we're going through a really expensive period for construction because of labor issues and labor costs. I mean, it's hard to predict all those things. I just don't buy this business that you're saving money by stopping the project. That I don't buy, and I think that it's supposed to. You say she's trying to get out of it. I think that she's trying to message that she's not going to spend money during her term. She's going to cut costs.
One more wheeled story because we're going to move on. Is that this week Seattle changed its parking rules? Developers can do more building without providing off-street parking, so that means fewer parking spots per person. But the city also says we have plenty of parking spots, but you can't use them because they're in private parking garages. So the city will also let landlords rent out their parking spaces to people who don't live in the building. City Council member Rob Johnson says these new parking rules will A, make housing cheaper because it's cheaper to make a building with no parking spots, and B, it will nudge you out of a car toward transit, and we've got to make that nudge.
In a city that's growing by 70 people per day, we can't also absorb an additional 70 cars per day. That would be bad for our environment. Cars are our number one source of greenhouse gas emissions. That'd be bad for public safety. Cars are among the most dangerous things on our streets today. And it would be really bad for public health. There's a lot of data that shows the more you're in a car, the more likely you are to be unhealthy. So we need to do a better job of rationalizing the use of those millions of parking spaces that we have. And we think that this legislation is a really good way to start.
Mayor Durkin says she's going to sign it. How do you think Seattleites will respond?
It's not going to make things cheaper. I'm going to say that out the bat. There's no
not going to make housing cheaper?
No, it's a good thing. I agree that we should actually, you know, that we shouldn't be building parking spaces. I mean, I've been against it for forever. But the argument that it'll make housing cheaper in Seattle is bogus. I don't.
Why is that?
Because in a sense, when you remove cars, you're actually going to increase the value of living within the city. People like act as if the cars have this incredible investment attraction and all this stuff. No, actually, the very opposite is going to occur. When you remove cars and there's less congestion, the value of these properties is going to be actually increased because they'll be better for people. I mean, people will want to live there. They'll be attractive. And so to me, it's just like we still have a market situation, and those factors are going to kick in. And believe me, the value of homes will only increase.
This is fascinating, this idea. Just two different ways of looking at the same thing, because you hear plenty of people saying, look, the vast, vast majority, we drive cars because they're awesome and we want to park our cars. And, you know, that's the last thing we want. You're going to ruin downtown. And then we have the idea, boy, this is going to make it a paradise without all this parking messing up our lives.
Right.
It's fascinating.
There's a value to that.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm all for using those spaces that are just sitting there. That's smart. That's a good thing to do.
In the private garage.
Right. And I'm also so for this idea, which is, as Charles points out, just an idea of making housing less expensive. But we do sometimes around here have to think about the fact that 60% of Seattle either was or is zoned for single family. And we can't just say, you know, we're going to do all this rapid change, you know, put tons, you know, of cars on the streets and then wonder why Seattle's, you know, not the way it used to be, losing its soul. I mean, we have to sort of account for all of these things. That's the concern I have.
This is partly a reflection of the building code kind of catching up to personal behavior. I mean, right now, the millennial generation has many fewer cars per household than any of the other sort of age cohorts, and many than they used to have, many fewer. So more of the people that are renting these typical kind of apartments in South Lake Union and Capitol Hill, that kind of stuff, have cars and own cars at a much lower rate. So we are still, the argument goes, building too many parking spaces. And this is just a way to kind of bring that balance back. A lot of spaces in some of these buildings are going like 30% unused at night. So there is an argument about how much this will reduce housing costs for the actual renter. It is a fact that parking costs about $30,000 a stall to build. So if you're building less parking, the building does cost less. Now, some builders are benefiting that completely to the tenant. Some are taking that. But I do think it does reduce housing costs by how much can be debated. And I think that is where they're going. We already have in urban centers no parking requirements for buildings. So this is not kind of a new threshold. What they're doing is just expanding mm-hmm. the areas where builders wouldn't have to build parking. It's not a requirement that they do not build parking. It is simply a relaxation of them having to build parking. So if they want to, and most developers, even in the zones now where you don't have to build parking, still do it. They feel like they will market their units better if there's at least some parking, a stall for every
Charles
couple
Medede
units.
Charles Medede is not buying that marketing campaign.
But the point is, some developers are still putting parking in buildings, some cases too much, but still putting parking in buildings even when they don't have to because the market wants it.
The one no vote on this was from Councilmember Lisa Herbold, and not because she's a hidebound pro-car conservative, but she says we need to think more about the social justice impacts on low-income folks who need their vehicles, end of quote. And she says she sees no evidence that people actually give up their cars when parking gets tighter. They just have...
So also some of this, as you said, has been happening naturally because I saw a stat somewhere that said the number of cars per unit in, you know, some years ago was 1.5 cars and now it's 0.6. So this is happening anyway. So I don't know how much we need the city to be insisting.
Well, I mean, it's also, I'm really disappointed in a way, because no matter what, I mean, is you're talking about the health consequences that, you know, people are going to be out of their cars a little more. And then there's also this other thing where Jenny Durkin sort of like is encouraging electric cars, right, in the city and so forth and so on. And how can anybody disagree with all these kinds of developments? I mean, they're great. I mean, this is what a city should be. For a long time, the city has been torn apart and ruined. The experience of the city has been frustrated by cars. So this is a great thing. These attitudes, I have to side with them. But they come at a time when poor people are being shoved out of the city. And so, or, you know, it's almost like brown bread, right? It's, you know, it's good for you, but it's too expensive for most people. So they end up eating white bread sort of thing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so that right now, at a time when actually these benefits should be going to everybody, they'll be going to a small group of people, and the health consequences will shoot out to the suburbs and so forth and so on, where more and more people who are poor or of color are going to be living. So this is we have not solved this dynamic at all.
You know, for years, city planners have been wondering, when do we get credit for all the investments we have been made in all these alternatives? I mean, billions have gone into light rail. Millions and even billions have gone into Metro over time. Pedestrian paths, bike lanes, stuff I talked about earlier. I mean, they have spent so much in alternatives. They're finally able to get some dividend from that, right? I mean, they're finally able to say, hey, in places that are served well by transit and these big investments we've made, we're going to relax parking requirements. That's what they've done, and this expands that in those kinds of areas, well-served by transit areas. And that'll help lower costs. I mean, you ought to be able to get something eventually for all the money you've spent on transit, and they are finally getting that. Millennials are having cars less because they're using transit more, and therefore buildings can be cheaper because parking doesn't need to be as plentiful.
And one of the dividends, this is silly, but you're going to be able to use the up and down escalator when it's broken at those transit stations because of the mishap a few weeks ago. That was silly.
But, you know, Seattle, though, is also a leader right now in using, use of public transportation, right? In the numbers here, we're one of the few major cities where we have seen an increase of people using public transportation, where it's actually falling in most other cities. People are actually giving up on it more and more. And
is that partly because of Lyfts and Ubers?
No, I just think, for one, it's because we really, the bus situation has improved greatly in Seattle, and of course, the Link light rail.
He's talking about, but I think that you might be right, Bill, in what you're saying. I think that in New York City, part of the gridlock is attributable to Uber and Lyft and people trying to avoid the subway because it's been so troubled lately.
Yeah, rather than standing up and waiting in a crowd, you know what? I can bring up my app and someone's going to pick me up and I'm going to sit in an upholstered seat. And so it's maybe sucking some people out of transit.
And just to throw out the criticism, however, of this, there are, and you hear it all the time from neighborhoods especially, a worry that, hey, if you relax parking requirements, you're just going to push cars onto the street. So if I can't put my car in my building, I'm going to park it on the street. And if you make it more expensive to put my car in the building, I put it on the street, and that's going to suffocate streets even more. You hear that from neighbors. So there is this debate about how many households don't have cars, and are they in these kinds of buildings, and can you nudge them out of cars? I mean, it's not without a lot of pushback, this kind of relaxation of parking requirements.
But that's built into the idea that if you want people to do something less, you make it painful for them to do that.
And I do think, and you heard it with Rob Johnson, I do think it's not just trying to catch up with the fact that we do have fewer cars in some of these apartment-type cohort folks, but there is a nudge there. There is an attempt to, if you make parking harder and more scarce, you hopefully nudge people, is the argument you hear from Johnson and others, to maybe not get the second car, not get the first car, use transportation more. I mean, if you nudge people out of cars by this, that is a win, according to people like Johnson.
I prefer bludgeon, I don't like nudge.
How about nudging? and just finally on transportation, just to explain what Joni said, last month at the UW Husky Stadium light rail stop, people had to wait hours to take the elevator because they couldn't take the two broken escalators, which temporarily became stairs. But Sound Transit said walking on a broken escalator is a safety hazard, and that might change. Yesterday, the Sound Transit Board met, and apparently a broken escalator might not be as dangerous as they thought, and they might let you walk on them next time.
They're lucky people didn't stampede.
I don't know why that became a big story. I mean, has everybody been on Denny at 3 o'clock in the afternoon every day? I mean, people are like talking about waiting, for a couple of hours. It happened once, and it's a big story. Whenever public transportation breaks down and has a small issue, right? Yeah. It's everybody you know, blasts out of proportion.
It's usually
but,
fish on
but
the
But all
road
you road. Have to do is today go to Denny at 3 o'clock and you see this, you know, nonstop, I mean, clogs. And it's just like, my God. I mean, it's just like, this is why I also don't like this whole thing with the streetcar. Is that, again, I mean, yes, there are overruns. But my goodness, look at what's going on with you know, when we deal with cars and the infrastructure for cars, the amount of money we throw into it and all this. And the attitude is like, oh, they get their bike lanes. Oh, they get their this and that.
But Charles, this thing about the streetcar is not so much the overruns. It's overruns mixed with the streetcar that doesn't function well. You're all arguing for, wow, they'll be all integrated. Everything's going to go great. Yeah, except the South Lake Union streetcar, which was the first one, no one envisioned that it would have to cut through 45,000 people. And that's why it doesn't work. This is about whether it functions. We seem to accept overruns when we think something's going to function. But South Lake Union streetcar is not a screaming success.
Well, you know,
it's not.
You won't believe it, because pretty soon the tunnel's going to open and all our traffic problems will be dissolved overnight. And it cost us how much? You won't believe it. It'll be like going to the city of heaven. Much cars will be flowing through the streets when that tunnel opens. No, come on.
No, but we're trying to restrict behavior.
Charles is on fire today.
Charles is on fire.
One little asterisk about the streetcar and the overruns, if I can.
Yeah.
Because this isn't just your grandfather's overrun. I mean, most projects do have some kind of problem, and people have rosy numbers to try and get them approved at the outset. But what's looking like more likely than not is that there was some deliberate manipulation in these numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, the city attorney's office is actually studying the estimates that were used by SDOT. I've never actually heard of the city's attorney office. I mean, this is an investigation, not a review. So there is some claim and some email back and forth that suggests Metro, which operates the streetcars for the city, but Metro sent clear estimates about how much they think it would cost to run the streetcar and how many maintenance people. And they were millions above what SDOT used in their application to the federal government for money and their presentations to the city council. It looks like, at least the allegation is, they deliberately ignored real obvious estimates. So it wasn't just, hey, we want some rosy things, but we might have manipulated. That's the claim here in the streetcar, which makes it different than some of the other overruns.
Okay, so we're clearly going to have to levy gigantic fines against the city of Seattle, fines that will be paid for by the taxpayers of the city of Seattle. And that'll fix them.
In decongestion pricing.
In decongestion pricing. Okay, coming back in a moment, we're going to wrap up with some Baleen Bebop. Stay tuned. Okay, finally on KOW's Week in Review, let's go out with a couple quick items. Seattle Times reports QFC is considering rebranding itself as The Q. Good
How
idea?
Are they going to distinguish themselves from our TV station?
Uh-oh.
We call ourselves The Q.
Oh, that's too personal.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my.
We have a problem. apparently the company's already used The Q in some marketing materials and checkout areas. And so we already have some inequality between the letters Q, F, and C. The Q is much bigger and has a crown, so they might just go with the Q.
I think they think it sounds hipper or something like that.
They've just run out of ideas, you know. I mean, it's good. I mean, somebody might get a job doing that sort of thing for a little bit, you know. Mm.
And then they won't have the job.
And then they won't like the Q. Then they'll have to bring back the FC after a while.
It's a little bit confusing to me. QFC is a very strong brand that's been very successful. Why mess with it?
That's what they said when they went from Quality Food Center to QFC. Come on, QFC. No one's going to call it that. We all know it's Quality Food Center. Okay, let's keep going because after the show, I have an errand to run. I have to go to Puget Consumers Cooperative and pick up some items. So finally, this week, a University of Washington researcher made national news when she reported that Arctic bowhead whales are kind of like jazz singers. University of Washington oceanographer Kate Stafford figured that bowheads were probably like those most famous whale singers, the humpbacks, but humpbacks sing in a pattern. It turns out the bowheads vary it up. It seems improvisational. Like, I don't know, like how Miles Davis would sing if Miles Davis were a singer who was a whale. Oh, yeah. The media All over the country picked this up. The headlines, whales communicate by singing haunting jazz, Arctic jazz. And my favorite headline, man, those bowheads can really blow. Excited?
No, I'm not.
The thrill of discovery, Charles? What?
Oh, Charles.
I'm a jazz snob.
Okay.
Oh, so you don't like it mimicking it?
No, that sounds like noise to me, what the whales are
doing. That's what some people say about jazz.
Exactly.
I'm actually intrigued and think it's a great insight. I mean, what we are learning actually from, especially water-based mammals, I mean, dolphins, whales, is there's way more communication than we ever thought. And whether you want to call this jazz or not, there is something about the sounds they're hearing. Some of it seems to be mating, and that's kind of common in other animals. But there may also be some communication like there's food ahead, or the ice is thin on top of this ocean we're swimming under. I mean, I just think it's inevitable that as time goes on, we're going to learn more about the sophistication of communication between all kinds of animals, but certainly things like whales and dolphins.
I think,
yeah, man.
I think that's just how they sound.
That's crazy.
I think it's fascinating too. I mean, I wish I could understand, you know, all of what they're saying or some of what they're saying. And remember, bowheads were almost extinct at one point. They were hunted so much. And so I think we're really lucky to learn about this going on under the ice like that.
Thanks, wow. UW researcher. Thank you, everybody. That's it for today. I appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you. Charles Mudede, filmmaker, film editor at The Stranger, culture critic. C.R. Douglas is political reporter for Q13 News. Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. See you soon.
See you soon.
Let's do it again soon. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.